show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are, a minute past the hour on Friday, the 10th day of May, 2013. Friday on the front porch. So, it's been a warm one here in almost level West Bicod, Virginia. Just mosey up, grab a pull out of the earthenware jug over there, or a cool glass of sweet tea, whatever you like. Put your boots up on the porch rail, kick back, and we'll cuss and discuss for a couple of 3 hours this evening, this afternoon, tomorrow morning, depending on where you are. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where the Listen Live button is. That's where the PayPal button is. That's where the traditional carbon-intensive mail address is for the contributions that keep all of this going. And we do earnestly thank you for those contributions. A challenge on the table tonight, it being the 1st of May. Shirley has sent in her Wisconsin challenge. And it doesn't apply just to people from Wisconsin. But there's $150 on the table this evening, hoping to find some friends to help us catch up at the end of this week with some of the hole we dug for ourselves at the end of last April. This past month, that is. So $150, looking for $150 to match in any way you see fit. 25, 10 at 15, 15 at 10, 2 at 75, 3 at 50. Makes no difference. But it is badly needed. Yep, Friday on the front porch. And, hey, you know what? We can begin with what looks like a little bit of good news. You know, over the past couple of nights, I have been perturbed, to say the least, that at the rearing of its ugly head, these old social, and I even hate that, we had a conversation about this with Dr. John sometime back, the so-called social Darwinism arguments that keep rising up out of the right wing, this latest case being that of Jason Richwine, a Weasley-looking little, who helped author an immigration study for the Heritage Foundation. You remember the one. They're
going to get all our Medicares. Brown people.
Yeah. Like, as I noted, like, the right wing actually gives a rat's rear end about things like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security.
Well, how can we steal it if the brown people get it all?
Oh, that's the point. Okay. And so it turned out Jason Richwine got a dissertation in a gumball machine, apparently somewhere near Harvard, by arguing that Hispanic people are not as smart as whomever it is that he refers to as white people. Well, it turns out that Jason Richwine has ties among other things, to racist anti-immigrant groups, you know, that kind of stuff. And I guess the heat got a little tiny, teeny bit too warm for the Heritage Foundation because they issued a statement today, you know, end of the week, Friday evening at news dump.
Jason Richwine let us know,
now that Jim Demented is running the Heritage Foundation, do we have to mush it up a little bit?
Jason Richwine let us know He's decided to resign from his position. He's no longer employed by Heritage. It is our long-standing policy not to discuss internal personal matters, personnel matters. Man, you know you've gone around the racist bend when even the Heritage Foundation doesn't want anything to do with you. So, he doesn't have a cushy job at the Heritage Foundation now. But you know what that means, right? He's going to find some right-wing school that'll say, what? You want to argue that the brown people are dumber and they always going to be dumber? Well, come on in, son! Yeah, maybe Bob Jones University or Jerry Falwell U or perhaps, George Mason or maybe Patrick Henry School of what the... But he ain't at Heritage no more. Even Heritage, even the Heritage Foundation.
Heritage!
Even the Heritage Foundation was getting a little askance about the idea of having a Kliegel on its staff. He wanted to, by the way, he wanted to break it. He didn't want to say, you know, brown people. He wanted to use IQ and his argument that IQ was the determining factor and that low IQs are just what happens with Hispanic people. It's just dumb. And so he argued that we needed to engage in bigotry against immigrants based on high skill and low skill. Well, you want to bet he's got a Confederate flag tacked on his bedroom wall. It just seems, yeah. But before that story came out, another one came to my attention. Those folks over at the Pew Research outfit came out with some polling data yesterday. Headline, high school dropout rate at record low, Hispanic high school graduates pass whites in rate of college enrollment. Now, you remember the beginning of Idiocracy, Bubba. I'm on all of y'all. But Richard Fry and Paul Taylor over at the Pew Research Hispanic Center write a record 7 in 10, that's 69%, a record 7 in 10 Hispanic high school graduates in the class of 2012 enrolled in college that fall. 2 percentage points higher than the rate among their white counterparts. This is based on Census Bureau data. Moreover, since about 2008, Hispanic enrollment in college is going up. White folks' enrollment in college is going down. I'm sure that Jason Richwine is working furiously on a paper right now that says that that's because of some sort of preferential affirmative action treatment. Jesus. And they write, the positive trends in Hispanic educational indicators also extend to high school. The most recent available data show that in 2011, only 14% of Hispanic 16 to 24-year-olds were high school dropouts. That's half of what it was in 2000. The good news, well, at least fewer white folks are dropping out, too. I'm sure none of this has any impact whatsoever on Jason Richwine. Super genius. Maybe he can get a job with Acme as a rocket roller skate tester or something.
Maybe you can test earthquake pills.
Yeah, me too. Me too, Sandra. Sandra tweeting, I'm still stuck on the fact that you can get a racist PhD from Harvard. What was the defense process like? And you kind of feel like the fix had to be in for that, right? Thomas provided us that diary from, I think, Empty Vessel over at Daily Coast that looked at his dissertation panel and suggested that something was probably a wee bit on the dodgy side. And really, even though this racist freak is leaving the Heritage Foundation, as in now, you know, no work. Isn't that interesting? Didn't work out a notice or anything? That's some resignation. That smells like fired. But the point being that even though that much has happened, there still does need, and I think that sounds a little bit like where Sandra's coming from, there still needs to be an accounting from Harvard and from the Kennedy School of Government and from those three clowns that gave him a PhD, that passed on his PhD. I mean, what was that defense like? Well, I've got data here that show that there's more success among light-skinned Hispanics than dark-skinned Hispanics. You know, cue up Garrett Morris and Andrew Young from that famous old Saturday Night Live skit. Lottie asking in the chat room, do they offer an undergrad degree in homophobia? This is just a little internet radio show and everything. But, Harvard? Guys? Is this really what you want people thinking of your institution? That you give out PhDs from your school of government to people who are just recycling 200-year-old racist horseshit? Because that's what they did. Slate has a rather lengthy backgrounder by David Weigel on this. And he says, 4 years ago, long before he joined the Heritage Foundation, before Marco Rubio was even in the Senate, Jason Richwine armed a time bomb. That's a little bit strong there, Mr. Weigel. A three-member panel at Harvard's John F. Kennedy. Really? Yeah. That's the other thing that's just so disgusting. This is the John F. Kennedy School of Government. And they accepted Richwine's thesis titled IQ and Immigration Policy. In it, Richwine provided statistical evidence that Hispanic immigrants, even after several generations, had lower IQs than non-Hispanic whites. Immigration reformers were fools if they didn't grapple with that. So, the folks at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government have some splaining to do. Let's see. Here we go. At the start of his dissertation, Richwine thanked his three advisors, George Borges Borjas, Christopher Jenks, and Richard Zeckhauser, for being so helpful and so bold. Borjas Borges, quote, helped me navigate the minefield of early graduate school, he wrote. Richard Zeckhauser, never someone to shy away from the from controversial ideas, immediately embraced my work. Embraced, Zeckhauser did. Embraced. Zeckhauser was interviewed by Mr. Weigel for this story, and he said, Jason's empirical work was careful. Moreover, my view is that none of his advisors would have accepted his thesis had he thought that his empirical work was tilted or in error. However, Richwine was too eager to extrapolate his empirical results to inferences for policy. And then, the professional backpedaling made easy? They interviewed Borges. Somebody tell me, is it Borges or Borjas? I don't know what to do with this J. The goddess of irony would have it be Borjas. I have never worked on anything even remotely related to IQ, so don't really know what to think about the relation between IQ, immigration, etc. Bill said in an email. In fact, as I know, I told Jason early on, since I've long believed this, I don't find the IQ academic work all that interesting. Economic outcomes and IQ are only weakly related, and IQ only measures one kind of ability. I've been lucky to have met many high IQ people in academia who are total losers, and many smart but not super smart people, well, isn't that nice with the guy from Harvard to say, who are incredibly successful because of persistence, motivation, etc. So I just think that on the whole, the focus on IQ is a bit misguided. That was a couple of weeks ago, or a week ago or so. But the day that he defended his thesis, his dissertation, oh, they loved it. Weigel writes, anyone who works in Washington and wants to explore the dark arts of race and IQ research is in the right place. The city's a bit like a college campus where investigating taboo topics is rewarded, especially on the right. A liberal squeals racism and they hear the political correctness cops, most often the Southern Poverty Law Center, reporting a think crime. What? So, let's see, in 2008, Richwine declared, decades of psychometric testing has indicated that at least in America you have Jews with the highest average IQ, usually followed by East Asians, and then you have non-Jewish whites, Hispanics, and then blacks. These are real differences. They're not going to go away tomorrow. Wow. And the Heritage Foundation thought it would be good to have this guy author their seminal work opposing immigration reform. So while the people who gave him that gumball with the PhD in it are a little worried about it. Well, they weren't in 2009. Bravo, old shoe. Here's your PhD. Go forth and do good racist things, my boy. Jesus. So one wonders, you know, will it be that... Will it be Pepperdine University? That's very right-wing, isn't it? Patrick Henry? Pat Robertson University? Jerry Falwell U? Bob Jones? He'll float back to Earth and land on a comfortable cushion of bigotry somewhere at one of these institutions that not only tolerates it, but cherishes it and advances it too. Happy news. At least people were paying attention, you know? Jack in Shreveport writes, Bob, dissertation topics are not picked lightly. and topics are not explored without funding and supervision. And they have to be approved by more than one person. When you said the fix was in, you may indeed have been correct. And thus my query, does this cast a big enough pall or a broad enough shadow on the Kennedy School of Government to make people wonder just exactly what it is they're doing there? I mean, goodness gracious, we were talking about Ashley Judd a while back. She's got a master's from the Kennedy School of Government, I think. So does another individual that I know. And I know them to be decent and hardworking people. But this clown just devalued everybody else's work. Not to mention the good reputation the Kennedy School had. Note usage of past perfect. Because I don't know about you, but I'm never going to hear the name Kennedy School of Government or Harvard without thinking, wait a minute, isn't that the Cal College that gave the PhD to the racist guy? Yeah. So there's that. A couple of cop stories in the stack tonight. One stranger than the other. One, sadly, all too typical. The all too typical one comes out of Baltimore. Makia Smith has filed a lawsuit against the Baltimore Police Department, Police Commissioner Anthony Batts, and police officers Nathan Church, William Pinkerton Jr., Nathan Ulmer, and Kenneth Campbell. It is a violation of civil rights claim. It stems from something that happened when she was in a traffic jam in North Baltimore. The rush hour traffic was just stock still. Nobody was moving. When she happened to look over and see several policemen beating the tar out of someone. What I have come to refer to as a police riot. Because, you know, that's what's going on when five or six uniformed officers decide to beat the stuffing out of one individual. That is, it's kind of a riot. They are running riot. So she pulled out her phone, which, you know, all phones now have video cameras in them, and stood on the door sill of her car and started videoing the beatdown. And that's when Officer Church turned around and saw her doing it. And took off a running toward her. As he ran, he hollered, "You want to film something, bitch? Film this!" That's when he reached into the car, grabbed the phone, threw it on the ground, and stomped it under his boot. Then he dragged Makia Smith out of her car by the hair, and began to beat her. That's when Officer Pinkerton showed up. That's when Officer Ulmer showed up. That's when Officer Campbell showed up. And rather than pulling an obviously criminal cop off of an innocent citizen, they decided to get in and whip her ass some, too. Meanwhile, properly strapped into a child safety seat, her two-year-old daughter watched her getting mercilessly beaten. Makia Smith cried, wept, screamed, begged the officers to please call her mother for the sake of the infant. Their response, however, was to say that, no, we're going to call social services and they'll take your baby and you'll never see her again. That's when they arrested her and put her in handcuffs and took her to jail. The charges they filed were assault on an officer and resisting arrest. It took two court appearances at which the complaining officer refused to show up before a prosecutor would finally drop the charges. Just another day in America. There are questions left unanswered by this account. For instance, what happened to the man who was being beaten and the evidence of which beating was destroyed by Officer Church? Ironic last name, isn't it? Did they go back and beat on him some more? Or were there spare cops to beat on him that when Church and Ulmer and Pilkerton and... We don't know. She incurred costs in hiring a lawyer. She had to get her automobile out of impound. And how long does it take for the nightmares about of an incident like that to stop? I don't know. How long does it take, or what happens to a visual memory, an auditory memory like that, as it gets tucked into the psyche of the very malleable psyche of a two-year-old infant? That's Baltimore. Baltimore has a cop problem. Cincinnati has a cop problem. L.A. has a cop problem. There's not a major city in this. Good God, New York City has a cop problem. There's not a city in this country that doesn't have a cop problem. Remember that study from a few years back? Or that lawsuit that was based upon a study where police departments deliberately don't hire intelligent people. Now, this is different than Jason Richwine making an argument like, you know, people with a certain skin color have lower IQs than people with another skin color. That ain't that. But remember when it was discovered that a civil service board would not hire a person with a score higher than X? To be a cop? I thought of that when I read this story. Dragged her out by her hair. And she'll probably have to try this thing, or take it very nearly to trial, before it settles. Been an interesting week. Cop slamming a little girl's face into a file cabinet at school for falling asleep because she had diabetes and sleep apnea and asthma. Yeah. Women missing for 10 years that never even really left the neighborhood, that the gumshoes couldn't find. And then there's this from the other side of the spectrum. And when I read this, I thought, yeah. It's the story of 31-year-old Etta Lopez. She's from Sacramento. She became desperate. I think that's at least an appropriate word to use. She became desperate to quit smoking. And somehow or another, inside her mind, she cooked up the scheme for how she could go about doing it, because she didn't feel like she was strong enough to do it on her own. So she stood around outside the Sacramento County Jail for hours on end until an officer walked out, then walked up to him and slapped him. She was immediately put under arrest and put in jail, where there's a no-smoking policy, where she had to go cold turkey. Kind of lends a compelling quality to the difficulty that getting off the nicotine Jones presents for a lot of people. It is, of course, that way by design from the tobacco industry. The tobacco industry generally doesn't like for people to quit smoking until they die. Therefore, they make their cigarettes incredibly addictive. So much so that you would be willing to have yourself incarcerated just to try to get clean of it? Apparently so. I hope to goodness she gets to quit and stays quit. It is, without a doubt, a brutal addiction. But I guess we can say that that story has a happy ending, because even though she slapped the officer, there's nothing there to suggest that he then beat the stuffing out of her. Maybe it's because there weren't 6 or 7 other cops around to, you know, help out. Pathetic. Sad. And once again, pointing out the fact that while we have so-called rehab clinics where, gas bag right-wing talk show hosts can go and talk to horses until they get over their opiate Jones, if they did, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. We don't have any such places, really, for people who need to kick nicotine. Booze? Yep. Drugs? Yep. Sex? Even sex. Cigarettes? Nah, you just figure that one out by yourself, Buster. Go figure. Jim writing in, are you kidding? Why would any intelligent person wish to be a beat or road new centurion? Well, there are people out there who enter the job with good intentions. But there's a culture inside law enforcement that changes a person, without a doubt. So, too, does seeing a steady stream of screw-ups and sometimes vicious people. It makes a person expect people to be screw-ups. And then there are those who wish to go into law enforcement because they are, in fact, low IQ individuals who like the idea of having a gun and a badge and bullets and a fast, albeit not particularly sexy, automobile to drive around. It's true. So, while I never felt the urge, and apparently Jim didn't either, and most of us, and then again, we're liberals, we're progressives, so we're not inclined to be turned on by that whole authority thing. But there certainly are in this country. There certainly are. So we've got that going for us. What else? On this Friday on the front porch. This is kind of funny. As the whole Benghazi kerfuffle heats up and tries to become whitewater for the second decade of the 21st century, you've got freaks like Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma in the Senate, who goes on right-wing hate radio to complain about Hillary Clinton and the way she dressed down. Who was the freak? Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who made an ass of himself, and Hillary then obliged him by helping out to make him even more of an ass. Inhofe showed up on a radio show with a cretin by the name of Rusty Humphreys. That's the guy that Ron in Raleigh was noting that an allegedly progressive radio host had taken to swanning around with. So Inhofe goes on the Rusty Humphreys show to complain about Hillary Clinton, saying that, you know, when she appeared before our committee, she had a forceful attitude. He said, I think she's gotten by with that type of forceful attitude, something that's not normally accustomed, that you don't hear from women as much as you do men. And she came out so forcefully, and you could tell that it was orchestrated at the time that she said it. Really? You could tell? What does Bart Cop call him? Bisquick. He could tell it was orchestrated. You know, I watched the same thing, and it seemed rather impromptu to me. It seemed to be a manifestation of intense frustration from then-Secretary Clinton over... Well, you got the idea, she was not suffering fools gladly that day. But don't you love that? You don't hear that from the women folk as much as you do the men. That, of course, is one of those snide back references to the old trope that they advanced all through the 90s, that Hillary Clinton wasn't sufficiently feminine. I guess she was supposed to be showing up in bonnets and hoop skirts. Meanwhile, you knew this was coming, didn't you? Pisquick
told Rusty Humphreys, people may be starting to use the I word before too long. And Rusty Humphreys, towering right-wing intellect, said, the I word meaning impeachment? No, the I word meaning IHOP, you right-wing. Yeah. That's what Inhofe answered the question. Yeah. Now, when a Jim Inhofe, who was pretty well tapped into right-wing lunacy inside up on Capitol Hill, when he says somebody, people may be starting to talk about the I word before too long, you can kind of go to the bank on that. That means somebody over there in the monkey house that is the House of Representatives is talking about impeachment. Because they don't care. It's like Liam Neeson in that one Scots movie where he said, don't you know I'm well past caring? They're well past caring. Anything. They get outmaneuvered, outbrained, outthought by the administration, and it's driving them nuts. So look for an impeachment committee to be impaneled over Benghazi any day now. And you're thinking, of course, as am I, over what? There's no there there. We spent $70 million over no there there with Whitewater. We spent $70 million for Kenneth Starr to sit in the bathroom and masturbate over Monica Lewinsky. Hell yeah. I imagine the I word is being bandied about a little bit, don't you? Yeah, that would be Rob Roy. Very quick on the draw there, Marty. Yeah, Rob Roy. Don't you know I'm well past caring? Hey, thanks. Big thanks to Sal for being the first one to pitch in this evening to match Shirley's Wisconsin challenge. Thank you, Sal. And thank you to Diane as well. Jim writing in regarding Secretary Clinton. I've worked for several women who ran a tight ship and did not suffer fools gladly. Believe me. Yeah. But see, when they run up against a senatating Jim Inhofe, they're supposed to be all retiring and shy, delicate flowers of femininity and gentility. Oh, I do believe I'm getting the papers. Somebody call Aunt Pity Pat. At which point Lindsey Graham says, somebody call my name. Now, so, you know, sit back, relax, because that's what's coming. That's what's going to occupy the right wing's imagination for the foreseeable future. Benghazi! Well, that and one other thing. Story coming out this morning. One of those where you go, oh, no, really, please. No. Some genius over, and I don't know, maybe Philip could fill us in on how this process works. And I'm not conflating the two or anything, but some genius over at the IRS decided to subject 501c3 documents to heightened scrutiny if things like Tea Party or Patriots or American Tea Patriot Parties showed up in an application. Because that IRS worker was concerned that they were trying to sneak some politicking through under the guise of a 501c3. The woman who runs the IRS unit overseeing tax-exempt groups is named Lois Lerner. And she said that low-level workers in the Cincinnati office flagged about 300 applications for additional review based on a keyword search. None of them had their status revoked or denied, and the IRS apologized for what it had done. But the drumbeat of, oh, Jeebus, we're being persecuted, has already begun. Really? It's pitiful. But this is a self-inflicted wound. This did not have to happen. This could very easily... And the thing is, underlying this, no, nobody lost their status, nothing was denied, nothing was revoked. But the fact of the matter is, these teabagging outfits are no more a charitable tax-exempt organization than I am. We've actually got a better, but never mind. Right-wing organizations have abused their status for years. And sometimes they do it openly and notoriously. For instance, every year when they have Preach from the Pulpit Freedom Sunday or whatever, where they fairly beg the IRS to come in and take away their tax-exempt status because they want a Supreme Court challenge so that the ban on politicking from the pulpit can be overturned once and for all by the cadre of weird freaks who show up at work at the Supreme Court wearing little pieces of barbed wire around their legs and hair shirts and beat themselves with fly whisks in the interim. So just kind of keep a weather eye out for some rather decided paranoia. Well, fresh paranoia. From the right wing. Jack in Shreveport pointing out, well, Bob, that explains why the IRS has been trending on Twitter for quite a while now. Oh, and Benghazi is too now. You gotta give it to them. They're organized. Way more so than we are. Yeah, that I love that graphic, Sparky. In the chat room, the guy with his hand up against his forehead with Excedrin headache number 7312, and the caption that says, "Oh, geez, not this shit again." Yeah, it is. Never should have mentioned IHOP. Sergi says, "Damn, I want pancakes now." Hey, listen. You know what we say? You know what we say around here? IHOP stands for intentional hair on pancakes. We do not go to IHOP. No less than two separate occasions. I mean, and they're slow, very slow, getting your order to you. No less than two separate occasions. One time with Ferg. One time with me. Our meals finally arrived. And this was some years back. It's kind of, oh, what, he was maybe 10? No, maybe 8. But he was eager. You know, kids love pancakes. And he was very eager, and the pancake, and he just reaches down onto his plate and pulls this long, long, long blonde hair off of his plate. And being a curious 8-year-old, holds it up and kind of looks at it. And after a while, the other patrons start looking over at Ferg, looking at the hair. And I'm a little more discreet. When mine showed up, I just sort of said, check. And asked them if they could kindly adjust the bill for the hair that I didn't order. Sure, Lottie, sure. It's like having a fly in your soup. You just eat around it. It's Friday. And there I... Well, that's two nights in a row I've ruined somebody's dinner. Sorry. Yeah, food porn portion of the program. I like the Krusty's mix, pancake mix, too. Very good. So that's just a little soupçon of stuff to get us started. By no means is it the be-all and end-all of what gets us through the night. I mean, I don't listen to Alan Colmes, but I've got an Alan Colmes clip here that's kind of for the ages. It's funny. And for once, it's not funny because somebody is, well, I mean, nobody's being mean to Alan. He's actually getting to twist the screws a little bit on a right winger. It's enjoyable. There's that. Let's see. Oh, not tonight. Ooh. Ooh, there's Jason Richwine again. Oh, by the way, up in Minnesota, you know, we reported the happy news last night that a marriage equality bill has made its way through the Minnesota House of Representatives. It'll be taken up by the Minnesota Senate, and there's a very strong likelihood that it'll pass and be signed into law by Governor Mark Dayton. Well, the other side has been heard from. Representing Peggy Scott, a Repiglican from Andover, Minnesota, has issued her statement on the passage of the bill that would afford full constitutional citizenship to people, because this is a citizenship issue, it's a rights issue, to people who happen to be gay. And it turns out that representing Peggy Scott, she said, of the passage of the bill, my heart breaks for Minnesota. People being able to marry the people they love breaks her heart for Minnesota. And then this. I'm guessing Peggy Scott is not a Mensa member. My heart breaks for Minnesota, she said. And then referring to marriage equality, she continued, it's a divisive issue that divides our state. She said as she wiped tears from her eyes. It's not what we needed to be doing at this time. We want to come together for the state of Minnesota, and we don't want to divide it. They have no clue. They are absolutely clueless. They do not understand that every time they open their mouths on this issue, their little lacy Freudian slips just poke right out. We want to come together for the state of Minnesota. Not to put too graphic a point on it, but so do some of the people that want to get married. But I, as a follower and rather of an aficionado of language, I was fascinated by her trenchant one-sentence analysis about the marriage equality debate. It's a divisive issue that divides our state. This assertion brought to you by the Department of Redundancy Department. It's a divisive issue that divides our state. How can you challenge reasoning like that? Wouldn't you just kind of expect that divisive issues would divide things? She wept. It gave her a sad, because people who love each other will be able to commit to each other legally and then be able to participate in the full panoply of the American experience. It made her sad. It hurt her Jesus. Not anybody else's, not yours, not mine, but it hurt her Jesus. Gave him a sad too. So, that's where we find ourselves at the close of the filibobster for this Friday, the 10th of May, 2013. $90 to go in the Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. 9 at 10, 18 at 5, 2 at 45. We can get there. So we'll take a break. Light up the phones. It's our last chance to talk before the weekend is upon us. 304-658-3333. The Skype line is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. And we will continue the cussing and the discussing in short order. This is Conversation Radio on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Two past the hour. Hour and about 55 minutes of good conversation ahead of us, I hope. Friday on the front porch. That's what it's for. And with very little delay or ado, to the phones we will go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, yeah, thanks for last night. I appreciate that. Man, that was recorded back in 1980.
Really?
Yeah, we picked that up from, well, I took the band in a direction that was away from the traditional Chicago guys and was starting to pick up on guys like there's three guys named King that were great guitar players, BB, of course, but the guy that we were listening to was Albert. And Vaughn listened to Albert quite a bit. And, of course, Albert had that, he was geared to playing rhythm and blues. I'm sorry, the lyrics were a little hostile for this show.
Not really.
Yeah, it was just the way that I didn't write this song. I just loved playing it and singing it. But yeah, we got heavy into those guys. The Albert King, the guys he recorded with, that was American band. You know, Steve Cropper and Dunn were Caucasian, and Booker T and the drummer were African American. I forget the drummer's name. He died young. And then they threw that Stax-Volt horn section behind those guys. And I've heard they tuned those Stax-Volt horns a little funny to get that sound, but I don't know. That's just what opinions you hear.
I just loved it.
It's what made us popular was when you get into the R&B thing, people could dance.
Yeah.
When they can dance, they're happy. And when they're happy, they come back again. And when they come back again, I eat better. It's the old story, you know. And have an audience is a great thing. But getting away from that and talking about this, all this Benghazi stuff. I read a book on the Desert Fox himself, Rommel, when I was about the fifth grade. And one chapter was on Benghazi. Benghazi was a city in, what was it called? Serenica, it was, Libya was an Italian colony.
Right.
And the British had kicked the devil out of the Italians in 1941, I think, in North Africa. And Hitler sent Rommel and a bunch of them. They had German Africa Corps over there. And man, those guys chased each other back and forth across that territory. But to hear these guys talk today, it's just ridiculous. These people are just out of this. I think some of them are so dumb. They think that Benghazi was a guy who portrayed a doctor on television, you know, like in Benghazara. But, I mean, they really don't know the first damn thing about what they're talking about.
No, but I don't think that's, I mean, they're Repiglicans, Bill. Yeah. We kind of expect that out of them. It's they're willing to make to attempt to make something out of nothing by screaming a lot.
Yeah, make a lot of noise about it. And that's, you know, it's not the first time in this country. You know, George Meade, who commanded the Union Army at Gettysburg, who was handed the job 3 or 4 days before the main event. Here, take this. Oh, my God, you know.
Yeah.
His parents were diplomatic people.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, I guess it was his dad was in, and when he was born, the family was in Spain in diplomatic service. And there was criticism during the war by imbeciles. Meade wasn't really a citizen because he was born in Spain.
I had no idea there was 19th century birtherism.
Oh, yeah. Ignorance is, it never stops, Bob. It just keeps going. And they'll find more ways to be ignorant. I mean, Mr. Obama, President Obama, has not made a lot of us happy in everything he's done, but I mean, anybody connected with the administration can't blow their nose without somebody criticizing the size of the handkerchief. Or
wanting to see the end result.
Yeah, because it just reaches a point of ridiculousness. It's one of those things, here, let me block the progress of this country with some more of this manure.
Well, this thing from Jim Inhofe.
She was too forceful. You know, we don't like it when the women folks do that.
Well, I know some women that have rolling pins and other heavy objects in the kitchen just the right size for that guy. They would fit perfectly. A little brain surgery, you know, maybe it knocks the sense into the guy. I don't know.
I'm betting against.
But I wanted to thank you again. And, yeah, that's when we got into starting to play. Because there's a friend of ours who listens to the, you know who I'm speaking of, who's also associated with the, one of the best modern R&B bands in the country.
Yep.
And, man, he sends me stuff that I just sit here and quake. You guys are so good. But we were lucky. It was the right place at the right time. And, you know, people, things were so unusual. I had a good booking agent. Hell, Bob, we were going up to the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit. We went up there once and opened for three Englishmen. One who was a fine guitar player. The group was called Cream.
Yeah.
We opened for Cream. We went back and opened for Three Dog Night and Steppenwolf. It was just crazy. And, of course, my favorite was Bonnie Raitt. We did a benefit with her for the Women's Indochina Peace Committee. And, man, what a performer she was. It just is.
Just awesome.
Oh, great. It was a great time to... And the guy that taught me, really, is a guy that never... is not real well-known. Paul Butterfield was my teacher as a harmonica player. He was the guy. But, you know, the thing about the guy who recorded that, he was a Volkswagen mechanic by profession. But he loved the company owned by the guy you used to work for in the radio business. What the hell was it? The one that Elvis recorded for.
Sam Phillips?
Sam Phillips, yeah. Because that's the sound he was trying to get with us, was old Sun sound. He was more... Because that was only four-track recording. You know, that's primitive as hell.
But, you know, it was delightfully clean.
Yeah, I was recorded live. He was upstairs in the bar we were playing, and he did a good job. He was probably, not only that, he took... You'd go into his shop at night when the shop was typical male auto shop owner. There'd be six Volkswagen Bug owners all working on his stuff in his place. And he wasn't charging us a nickel. He just was that kind of a guy. And he turned out to be a pretty good recording engineer. But I'll let you go. Thanks for playing it. That was the first thing we did, and then we did a couple more after that, and each one got more. As time goes on, you can watch the maturity of the people doing it. And you know, Bob, I hit a nice IQ test in the third grade, and probably never should have done this for a half of a living, but then again, isn't that kind of like being a radio talk man?
In many, many ways, Bill.
Some guy who has, you have an education in classical stuff that makes me feel so damn ignorant, it's pathetic.
Oh, please, no.
Man, when you start talking about the ancient, the early societies, you know, that's why I tune in. I learn something new every night from somebody who calls in, and I'll give them a chance to call in. And thanks again, sir. Take it easy. Enjoy the weekend.
You gigging anywhere tonight?
No, I had a good time last night. Got up and played three or four things. We did some stuff that, you know, you dig the stuff out of the... In fact, there's a song that was the B-side of Maybelline was a slow blues, and I forget the name of it right now. But see, I was lucky. I started listening to rock and roll in about 55 or 6 when Bill Randall was bringing Elvis into the high schools in Cleveland. Long before he ever appeared with Ed Sullivan, he was on with Steve Allen, and Randall brought him out when Tommy Dorsey was covering the Gleason show. Gleason would go on vacation. And Elvis was on the Tommy Dorsey show. That was a real first national show. But nobody remembers it because, you know, compared to Sullivan, the size of the audience was amazingly, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
Although Dorsey and those guys, and that's what really got me going with New Orleans guys and big band jazz, and then rock and roll fell out of the sky and hit me in the head. And,
You know, there's just something special about the blues that when you hear it, if you're the right person to be hearing it, Ferg is, you know, he's made tremendous strides with his guitar. He doesn't believe it, but he has. And you know, the fact of the matter is, what really, really gets him in the gut. I mean, he can hear something and then play it.
Yeah, that's skill, man.
But it's blues stuff that really just crawls all over him, Bill.
Well, ask him to check out guys like Michael Bloomfield and some of those early, and Lonnie Mack from working out of Cincinnati, out of Indiana. He did a great version of instrumental of Memphis, the Chuck Berry thing. Just tore it up, and that was like 65.
Well, I've tried to expose him to a good bit. He's heard a good bit of Stevie Vaughan. He's heard a good bit of the Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Oh yeah.
And I've played him some classic stuff, some Howlin' Wolf and some Muddy and.
Well, Kim Wilson stopped in this place I was playing, the Euclid Tavern, and I had to let him get up there, and it was torture to have to stand next to this guy and try to match what he could do. He is a tremendous player, Kim, and the Thunderbirds, man, what a bunch of hard-driving guys they were, too. There has been so many of us, and most of us never hit the big time, but most blues players don't either, and, you know, it's just, I'd rather do that than work in some, I mean, I did all kind of stuff. Bob, the TV repair, car repair, you name it, we did it. But that was the generational thing. I look at these kids today and say, well, you guys are being cheated out of the ability to take a wrench and cover yourself with grease and smile your butt off when the cars are running. That's a feeling that's hard to get.
Yeah, when the engine turns over?
Yep.
Yep. Before you go, Isaac says, ask Bill to tell his story on how he looked like Santa Claus.
Oh, I can't tell him. I can't tell that one. That's it was Isaac, never mind. You know the story. I can't repeat that one on radio. You take care of yourself.
You have a good weekend, Bill.
Thank you, sir.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress from Cleveland, played a... we've got a few other tracks we'll play periodically. Let's go to the Skype line. Sandra's with us. Hey, Sandra, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how's it going?
It's going.
Listen, I was wondering, did you see that article from Wire about the biometric database that may come out of this immigration bill?
Yeah, I don't know that I've seen some mention of that, and it's just creepy.
Anyway, it's called. I looked up, you know, blessed control F. I just love it. Anyway, I looked at the amendment markup in one of the committees to this bill that's sort of, you know, being hashed out, the immigration bill. And this photo tool, it says an employer seeking to hire an individual shall verify the identity using a photo tool, which apparently the Homeland Security, it will develop this database that is essentially going to have a photo of every, you know, adult working person in this country, so they can so-called match people looking for work. I mean, you know,
yeah,
this
that's
is
what
sort
it's
of like
for.
A,
sure.
Yeah, this is like some sort of, you know, national ID without the ID, because don't tell me that this isn't going to expand to basically be a permission to do anything. I mean, I think it's a very disturbing development that isn't getting much, you know, it's not being appreciated for what it can ultimately do. You know, you may have to use this to get on planes, you know, to
right and you know,
do anything.
Concurrent with that, not necessarily related to the immigration bill, but News Ninja Gene sent me a story the other day about an address that was given by the head of PayPal, talking about how in just a couple of years' time, passwords and PIN numbers will be gone.
Well, yeah, it'll be all bio. Yeah, they.
It's all going to be biometric, and it's and there will be fingerprint readers on smartphones.
Right, and that's what they're heading for. Are you going to have to? But you can, if they do that, they'll be able, they can use this so-called photo tool to, you know, you have to get permission from the government to go online. I mean, it's sort of endless what can go on. And, you know, this is sort of the natural progression of the Internet if it's not perfect, you know, on purpose made to be an open platform for communication. If it's used by these corporations and the government, I mean, this is what we're looking at here, you know, rubbing your eyeball on something to fucking check your email. I mean, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, I'm sort of a bit hesitant. I mean, I hate trying to remember passwords, too, but I don't trust, you know, I'm not in that trustworthy state. With
well, no, that was exactly my point. On the one hand, you've got the biometric stuff. And how is it that every American citizen winds up in this database in an immigration bill? Are we?
Well, that's what I mean. I'm just saying it's sort of no. I mean, this photo tool. I mean, they're going to have to establish some reference point. So eventually, it's going to require everyone to check in. Can we
right.
just say?
And see, that's the thing. On the one hand, you've got the government doing it with the photos. And if there's anybody I trust less than the government, it's the so-called private sector.
Oh, yeah.
Because
I mean,
they'll sell your data to the devil himself if the price is right.
And not only that, they get the extra power to all of a sudden start doing what should only reside with the state, which is punishment, you see. That's where it all sort of leads to, where you have private entities able to dole out more penalties than they already do. I mean, the debt collectors are already using the courts and the police to lock up people who don't pay their $300 Home Depot bill. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And where's the cutoff on this? I mean, do we take the baby's newborn picture and put it in the database? That, you know, I don't want to sound all Alex Jonesy or anything. But it's creepy as hell.
Oh, no, but this, yeah, I mean, I don't, yeah, it is sort of falls into that realm, but I mean, you know, that sort of conspiracy stuff just serves, yeah, you know, and then we, you know, it's just sort of, this is for real right here. You can find it yourself. There's no conspiracy. I mean, this is, you know, amendments, and this bill isn't, etched in stone, obviously, but, people need to be made aware of just how every major piece of legislation now is, you know, being tied into the security apparatus, you know?
Yeah, and so we can do this for people whose only failing in life is still being alive, put them into a database like this, but we can't have a background check to buy an assault rifle.
Well, right.
Square
I mean,
in that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, that comes down more to some vested interest wanting to be able to sell their goods than anything else. I'm not buying none of this liberty and freedom and all this crap. I'm just seeing a vested interest that has more dollars to play with than the other vested interests, and whoever has the most dollars wins. I mean, that's all it is in this country now. And you should see the level of lobbying that's going on with the for-profit private incarceration companies. I mean, they're, you know, it's too close. Why are they so all up in the immigration? Because they want to be able to lock people up, you know?
Well, that's, and again, you know, going back to last night's conversation, that's business now.
Right.
But this,
but
this idea that the database... Jack sent me the Wired article. The idea that this database would be accessible by any employer in the country or potential employer?
Yeah, I mean, no, it's just, you
no,
know, once again... No,
what could possibly go wrong?
No, I mean, we're back to the... There's no democracy here, you know, except for maybe when you are standing alone somewhere, because at the workplace, it's a dictatorship. And, you know, if you now have to ask the government for permission to do anything because they have their photo tool, you know, I mean, it quickly descends into some sort of, I don't know what we're going to call it, because the upside is there is no upside to what the U.S. is turning into.
None.
For the vast majority, because you get paid shit wages, and then you got to be tethered to this shit here. Oh my God! I mean, it's some sort of horror show. I mean, to me, I find the whole thing extra disturbing, and I find the coziness with the private prison stuff really disturbing.
Well, I mean, let's say just speculatively here. Let's say you get popped for speeding somewhere, and you know, in you go into the database. Monday morning when you go into work, is there going to be a flashing light on the HR director's computer with your little biometric photo on it showing that you got popped for speeding Friday night?
And say you're some sort of teenager trying to get your stuff together to go to college, and oopsie daisy, you have to get some plan B. Does that go to Wellesley or UC Berkeley where you're applying? I mean, it's never ending. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is, and it's
like, you know, you have to show your ID to get the birth control. Who else gets to see what you just bought? You see what I mean? I mean, it becomes unimaginably horrifying to me.
Well, and this is with the advances in technology. I mean, we've got a little personal experience with this here, and I'm not telling anything that's not generally known. One of my daughters had a cyst problem, and you know they prescribe birth control pills for that because it helps control it. So the local pharmacy tech told everybody, and so you know there's a little slut shaming going on, and it's still something that is deeply infuriating in this family. And that's,
well,
nobody had to have any pictures or, no, that's just, you know, nasty little small town gossip.
Right. Yeah, I you know, and it's just kind of,
and
when
of course,
I hear that.
And of course the person is a Christian.
Right. And it sort of, you know, went against their personal beliefs, so feel free to sort of ostracize somebody and completely invade their privacy. But if you're doing something wrong, you don't have any privacy, I guess, in their eyes.
No, not entitled.
I'm just saying, you know, these people are entitled to set the agenda for what's... I mean, did you have a look at that Thaw thing?
Oh, Jesus.
I don't know if you got to me. I don't know if you saw
No,
that
I
tweet.
Did. I sat there and watched it just in slack-jawed horror.
No. I mean, that one is just outrageous. I mean, I just was like, oh... What the hell? Yeah, I thought you would enjoy that. But
yeah, young evangelical Christian teens who are saying what's their tagline? Christianity is being forced out of the public square.
Yeah.
Where?
No, I mean it was just so gruesome. But that's, I mean, to me, it's just I don't know how, it's just all of it. It just smacks of. Just totalitarianism, you know, all of it just really, seems to be closing in. And, you know, if you look at a bit of legislation to, assimilate and make whole, undocumented folks, you think, great, this is a good idea. But then here we go with the, oh wow, what can we do to, metastasize even further this security state that has sort of popped up since 9/11, and it just goes on and on and on. And you got the Obama administration trying to so-called reform the wiretapping laws so they can just look at everybody's shit, and the Fourth Amendment is just completely gone. You've seen that story, right?
Oh yeah.
And they use the complaint, well, the technology is surpassing, you know, our laws, and that's always a load of bullshit. You know,
well, but it's also
it's
always the nature of law. Law is responsive and very seldom proactive, because when you try to make the law proactive, it winds up being a bigger mess than if you just deal with what comes.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think that the Fourth Amendment as it's written, covers, it's very adaptable. I'm not buying none of that. I mean, if you read the Fourth Amendment, it's really simple, but you substitute almost any technology for personal papers and effects. And that covers every damn thing. I'm not buying it, you know?
Yeah, effect. See, this is where we run up against, those creepy originalists. You know, there were no electronic documents in 1787. So consequently, you know, your fat Tony Scalia's, well, you don't know if it didn't. Because that's how he said, we have to consider the Second Amendment in the light of 1787, which is absolute bunk. But the fact of the matter is, the Fourth Amendment is one of the more clearly written amendments in the Bill of Rights. And it tells you exactly what has to happen. But, you know, not just from 2001 to the present, you know, back into the 80s and the 70s, especially with the rise of the so-called war on drugs, you know, invented by Nelson Rockefeller, you get these modifications to the Fourth Amendment that are just shocking.
Right.
Such that I don't necessarily know, you know, what do, because it was a fairly bright, that was one of the few bright line rules that we had, you know, sitting there in law school. Was that if the cops come to your door and knock on your door and you open the door and they say, we want to search, you say, do you have a warrant? And if they say no, then you say, come back when you have one.
Well, I mean, that's why I always liked Thurgood Marshall, how he just sort of said, you know, these sort of rulings are turning the Bill of Rights into some sort of ad hoc application. And that just applies to everything that they've done since, you know. Since I remember reading that dissent that he wrote for the emergency whatever they did in Boston recently, the public emergency thing, to not Mirandize people,
right,
you know, and so, but this whole business of the Obama administration, I mean, you know, they are just eviscerating the Bill of Rights here. It's incredible. And we're supposed to be grateful when they say, oh, well, these ones, these so-called, these terrorists in Boston, we won't treat them as an enemy combatant. Oh, thank you, dear leader. You see, I mean, that's where we're at, where we're holding our breath to see what the executive is going to do this time around. To me, that tells me that the Bill of Rights are already shot to hell. If we got to, like, go, woo. Wow, he decided to treat them as, you know, Americans. I mean, think about that.
Well, I've said, and again, I was saying this before 2001. The Fourth Amendment's been on life support for a very long time. If you want another dissent that is brilliant in its explanations, look at Justice Brennan's dissent in a case called U.S. v. Leon, and that's a 1984 case. You know, ironically enough. Of course, almost all of these things wind up coming from drug cases, which is, you know, we could do 3 hours on that. But it's a drug case, it's a search warrant case, and it was later found out that the search warrant, there was no probable cause for the search warrant to issue, and so it was challenged in court. And the majority held that the evidence obtained in the search was allowable because the police relied on the warrant in good faith. Well, ain't nothing about good faith in the Fourth Amendment. I mean, it's a real stinker.
Yeah. I mean,
I was just going to say, the dissent that Justice Brennan writes is scathing.
Well, I just think, you know, it's just kind of, this stuff just happens, and, you know, because we don't have a reasonable national media, you know, you don't get the information. Only a select few of us find this information out. Everybody else just gliding along, you know, and then you wake up and you're like, yeah, you have no more rights, you know.
Right.
Or you're cheering when some official says, stay in your house, and we'll let you know when to come out. And when they say come out, yay! I'm like, wow, have we been reduced to that?
Apparently, the answer is yes.
Yeah, and, well, anyway, I find that whole...
What's more insidious about this, though, if at some point in time the federal government said, martial law, cops, cops rule, you drool, whatever. Goodbye, goodbye Bill of Rights. Well, obviously they could never, they would be hard pressed to get away with it absent some pretty exigent circumstances. But what we see instead is this piece by piece, little by little, death by a thousand cuts approach to, some of the most profoundly important rights that American citizens hold. And search and seizure is damned well one of them.
No, but they're quite happy to roll over like that because, like I said, I mean, there's no way that a million people, which is the size of Boston, are going to, they don't have any real way of enforcing it except for conditioning. And we've had a decade of security theater, and people are pretty well conditioned. It's quite amazing.
Right, and that's because it happens in that sort of incremental way. That, it's the whole... Oh God, I hate to even go here either, but it's that whole frog in the pot in the water.
Right, boiling frog. Yeah. Well, anyway, I just sort of.
And I hate using that one because I remember when Glenn Beck boiled the frog on his show.
Oh right. Well, no, I just the immigration thing just kind of that was it took. Yeah, I was like taken aback by that.
It blows my mind, Sandra, because why is this in an immigration bill?
Right.
It's for that matter, if you're going to take up immigration, great. But, Marco Rubio is leading the charge on this in the Senate of the United States. He's leading from the minority party.
Mm.
What the? And there's another thing going on. I mentioned it a couple of nights ago, this Water Resources Development Act bill that's in the Senate is going forward next week. And lo and behold, and what it is, it's like a highway bill for water. Okay, it's all water projects, sewer mains and bridges and culverts and things like that. And everybody's got a piece of it, so everybody wants to see it pass, more or less. Enter my Senator Joe Manchin, who wants to put an amendment into it that will. That will eliminate the veto of the Spruce Mine here, which was this huge 9,000-acre sprawling monstrosity of a mountaintop removal operation that the D.C. Circuit recently said the EPA had the power to stop if it so chose to do. Well, again, what's that got to do with... But what I'm getting at, Sandra, is that we are, we're constantly told, and largely buy into it, that this government is hopelessly dysfunctional. It can't do anything because the Republicans obstruct everything, which is largely true. But by God, when they want to do something,
oh yeah, like the airport.
Yeah, when they want to make the planes land on time. Yeah, no
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, I mean it's true. I mean the other amendment with this immigration, I don't know if you saw this. It was just so blatant. It's like. Oh well, the laws that we're coming up with that will be prohibitive for illegals going forward won't apply to butlers, maids, chauffeurs, people who take care of your kids. All the people that these rich people desire would not be penalized.
Right, a law for thee, but not for me.
And it's incredible. It was. I'm like, oh my God, because it's so. It's just. I mean, it's so blatant. I think this was. I don't know what. It was one of those horrible senators, added this amendment to this immigration, and it was just like, unbelievable. Oh, listen. The only other thing I wanted to mention was that guy, and his name is so hideous too. Rich Wine.
Jason Rich Wine.
Well, the thing is, once again, these horrible tribes or conservatives, whatever you want to call the divisions in this country, they just wallow in their own silo because they all seem genuinely shocked when they get pushback, when they come out with some bullshit like this. I mean, it took them so long to say, oh, wow, maybe this is a problem. You know? Well, yeah, hell yeah. You're trying to say a whole group of people are low IQ because they're brown again. I mean, every time.
Well, didn't you love
white people?
Yeah, didn't you love his little hierarchy that he established in that one little round table that mentioned earlier? Among immigrants, the smartest are always the Jews, followed by the East Asians, followed by other white people, and then by Hispanics and persons of African extraction.
Yeah, I mean, no, but it's just, I'm like, what the hell? You know, and the thing I was looking at, that horrible, what's his name who wrote The Bell Curve?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God, it's, you know, but he had the nerve to tweet that, well, I guess it's Jim DeMint because, you know, I had great support under whatever idiots were running the Heritage before DeMint came in there. He was bitching because he feels like his colleague was sort of thrown under the bus. So it was sort of horrible eugenicists unite, criticizing DeMint because DeMint said, oh, no, this dude has to go. You know, DeMint, who's running the Heritage now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's the one that pulled the plug. It took him a while. But I'm just in awe that these idiots are, like, rolling out public forums talking about IQs and blacks and underclass and all this stuff that, you know, are we still here, you know? And they're still here. And the larger society is like, what the F? So they have to comply and get rid of this dude.
Yeah, but again, he's going to go somewhere and land very softly.
No. But I'm also concerned with these so-called elite institutions. I'm sorry. I'm not sitting around thinking that Harvard is okaying this kind of garbage. And my estimate of that place, I mean, I always thought they were all just full of it, but I'm really kind of like, wow, all right. So you guys have departments full of people who will sanction just eugenics. And it goes back to...
Well, we used to expect that kind of crap out of the University of Chicago.
Well, I guess they're all still like that. I mean, to me, you know, it's just like pulling the curtain back, and you get to see exactly... what's what. And I guess they thought that they could get away with that bullshit. I mean, the Heritage will go on, but they're taking a big hit on this, and good.
Yeah, it's like, let me see if I can order my thoughts here. Did you see the kerfuffle over that little community college in Florida with the thought experiment about writing the word Jesus on a piece of paper? This is a month or so ago.
No,
Okay, so it's like Central Florida, I think, or Florida Atlantic, or I think it was the same college that sold the naming rights to its stadium to the private prison company.
Right, okay, yeah.
Okay, so there's some sort of sociology class, or maybe it's anthropology or something going on. Maybe it's a psych class. And there's a thought experiment. And the thought experiment involved sensitivities around language. So at one point in time, the professor says, okay, everybody get out your paper, and I want you to write Jesus across the piece of paper. Now I want you to put it on the floor and step on it. And immediately some little right-wing evangelical started screaming that he was being oppressed for his faith. Okay? And so there was this huge backlash. You know, the president of the university comes out and says, oh, we're sorry, we'll never ask anybody to step on Jesus again. Oh, it was terrible of us. You know, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. And that's, you know, some shitty little university in Florida. Okay? I mean, it's big, and it's probably not shitty either, but that was bad. It's a public university that's not exactly known for cranking out research.
Right.
All right. Meanwhile, Harvard and this. Okay? There was a national outcry over that stupid thought experiment, and this little fundy freak didn't even understand that his response was actually what the thought experiment was about. Meanwhile, you go up to Harvard, and they've got guys making 200-year-old race arguments, and they're passing out PhDs, and there's no accountability.
And there's nothing. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I was, like I said in that tweet, I'm still stuck. I'm just stuck on the institutional aspect of it, and it's really disturbing. I just think it's just outrageous. But, yeah, but that thought thing you're talking about, I'm still looking at that, email with the stop stealing God's praise.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, we got to share that.
I was like, what? That was great.
Yeah, so yes. Maybe I hope I'm not violating some sort of privacy or anything. Isaac writes earlier today, and he says, people saying God didn't help save those women are some ignorant folk. Talking about the Cleveland story, the women who were... it was by the grace of God that they made it through all those years, and God sent that man to save them. Stop stealing God's praise. Isaac just said, I had to unfriend this. Got my blood pressure up.
Yeah, no. To me, I'm just, once again, just at a loss. I mean, that people exist in that world. I mean, it must be nice. Because by her logic, any horrific thing that goes on, including the annihilation of 6 million Jews, is God's plan, and when the Jews were rescued finally, 6 million dead later, that was, you know, when it all...
That was God's mercy and glory on display.
Right. And so, you know what I'm saying? I
mean, when even... Right.
It's no way to combat that. I'm just like... Well, how in the world do you fight that? Because if that is true, then everything that goes that just goes on is just based on that bullshit.
And see, people of good mind have been trying to penetrate this for years. I mean, I go back to thinking about Mark Twain's War Prayer, Sandra, where he explains that when you pray for rain on your crops, you're praying for drought on somebody else's. And that you know, when you pray for our soldiers to be victorious, you're praying for some mother and some wife to be rendered a widow. And they didn't get it then. We don't get it now. And people are afraid of the sky spook. And that's where we are.
Well, yeah, I guess it's just something that I just have to move on because I recently had some encounter with some freak at my job. I mean, that was his explanation. And then what's even worse is they think that it's okay for them to badger you with that bullshit belief too.
Right, but
Bob,
if you push back against them and say go babble to somebody else, then you're persecuting them.
No, right. It's like the thing is that it's okay in a society to have those types of views, where you can open your mouth and say crap like what you just read, blows my mind. But I've been told that I'm a naive person because that's how it is in this country, but I'm just horrified.
And yeah, it's not like this is confined to, Mississippi Stan or Alabama Stan or South or North Carolina Stan or Tennessee Stan or any of the other Stans. I mean, it's where you are. It's in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
It's in the enlightened parts of this country, because there's that old line about how a lie can make it around the world before the truth gets its shoes on. So can the stupid.
No, but it's pernicious because this particular conversation I was having was this man justifying some homeless person in the situation they're in, and that's where it devolved to.
Wait, God wants people to be homeless now?
Right, and if they are, they need to turn to the Lord to get their answers. You see what I mean? So it's really pernicious because it just basically says, well, this person is in this situation because of their own problems, and that's just, and it gives everyone an out. And so it's just, I mean, it makes you wonder how we ever managed to get any decent public policy in this country ever, really.
Well, and that goes back to that argument I made a while back that the moments of profound change in this country have lasted about 3 years, and they come about every 75 or so. And as far as I can tell, that's true. That line in that Thaw video about how and no matter what popular opinion says, this country was founded as a Christian nation. You know, if they say it enough, it'll make it true, I guess.
Right, and that whole thing, you know, it's just, no, it's so hideous that particular lie is really right. But we did have the first and second, you know, awakening, so, I mean, there's a long pushback to reason in this country.
Yeah,
from the get.
and it's a long, it's going to be a damn long climb this time, too.
Yeah, well, at any
but, I mean,
rate,
look at, I just, look at that, you know, look at that granny of the 5-year-old who killed the 2-year-old saying, well, it's just God's will and we don't understand it, but sometimes God needs to have a 5-year-old slaughter a 2-year-old, and that's just God.
No, I mean, you know, from something as horrific as that as to some fucking Tim Tebow getting a touchdown, I mean, it covers the whole spectrum.
Why can't Tim Tebow praise his Lord after a touchdown without causing a national scene?
Well, why does Tim Tebow need to, you know? But they don't understand that we ask those questions because of what fools they make of themselves.
Well, no, but it's also just really it's just disturbing, you know, in a macro sense, because as things go from bad to worse, you know, people just wallow in that shit, you know?
Well, right, and don't think these organized gospel sharps don't know it, Sandra. You know, during hard economic times, religious giving and religious faith goes through the damn roof.
Oh, I know, and I, you know, what are they going to, you know?
Because they got nothing else.
Well, I guess climate change is going to be a big old challenge.
Yeah, well, you know, they try to pray the gay away. I can't wait until they try to pray the seas back into the back off the shores.
Oh, they need to start praying for the parts per million. They better start praying that down. That one that went over 100 today or something.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And this story I saw that they've done core sampling of a lake in Siberia that shows them what the Earth was like the last time we got over 400 parts per million.
Yeah, no, it's really disturbing.
Yeah, that was when Siberia was a tropical swamp.
And they said, what was I reading, that people, man wasn't even, you know, around. But the other thing I wanted to, I didn't know if you, I mean, these are things that, you know, I don't know. You don't know unless you sort of do a little bit of research. But I had no idea that the amount of water that's being used for fracking is completely unaccounted for by states in a lot of these places.
No,
they're using so much water in the Dakotas. It's going to take 50,000 years for one of these aquifers to get back to the level it was only 10 years ago, Bob.
Yeah, I mean the whole fracking thing is a you know, it's the Wild West everywhere. Pennsylvania, I was talking on one of the late night Skype chats with Spike the other night, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, they take tankfuls of this toxic waste, it's no longer water, and just go out and, you know, there are cases of people being caught doing it, and just take the truck out into some, Pennsylvania, public land and open the tap and dump it.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's gone for good though, this water. Cause it's not like it can be, used again. And the thing that was really disturbing to me is that, the environmental agencies of these states are purposely not aware of their water resources. And I'm like, listen, money is not, you can't drink no money. You see what I mean? I mean, it seems to be just absurd on the face. Why in the world are you allowing your precious fresh water to go away? I mean, I need you to explain that to me, because it don't make no sense. I don't understand.
I mean, the explanation that I have coming from here and the work and the struggle we're involved in here is that, you know, there's money in that.
Okay, but the water, but so what? The people making money plan to relocate in the Himalayas?
Well, like they don't have to relocate. They don't live here in the first place.
Okay, but I mean, no, but you know what I'm saying? We're talking a lot of water, though. Like, water that millions and millions of people need for crops and for drinking. That's being sort of destroyed, from what I can tell, from what I've read.
I think what it boils down to, Sandra, is the profiteers are blinded by their insatiable hunger for profit. But by the same token, they cannot conceptualize issues on a scale like this. You know, I sit here and I talk about the Brushy Fork impoundment down in western Raleigh County that holds back 9.8 billion gallons of toxic waste. Okay? That used to be water. Who can conceptualize that?
Right. It's like the outer space numbers again, right?
Right.
But you know what?
You can conceptualize it real damn quick when you say 45-foot high wall of toxic waste traveling 100 miles.
Right, washing over everything and killing whoever is in the way and all around. I mean, but the thing is, then you read about this stuff and you try to find out, then you turn to news that, well, the Obama administration is going to relax what little protections there are with this fracking now. So, you know, what the hell?
And you know, the condemned ate heartily.
And also,
I mean,
you know,
this is the kind of stuff you can't put. I mean, those little pure filters that you put on your kitchen spigot.
Oh yeah,
those things work great, but
they
don't deal with this.
No. I mean, no, but this is sort of, you know, they seem to be quite happy to consign whole swaths of what was sort of fertile land where food is grown now, just to turn it into wasteland and the hell with the people who lived off of that land. I mean, I'm not understanding the logic. It's really outrageous.
Well, I think you could probably do a dissertation and actually defend it on the deliberate attempt to detach people from their real world that lies at the vicious heart of consumerism. Consumer capitalism, because it's that whole thing, you know, that idea that meat comes from the grocery store, so you never think about the giant CAFO lot, and the idea that those strawberries are luscious, and you never think of some poor sod who's breaking his or her back every day picking the damn things, and then is expected to stand in flames to keep doing it. You don't think about that. And you turn on the wall, you turn on the light at the wall socket, and that's where electricity comes from. It comes from the wall socket. It doesn't come from some godforsaken moonscape in Appalachia. And we are utterly and completely and totally disconnected from the realities of our existence. You know, bread comes from the grocery store, or maybe it comes from an artisanal baker, but it certainly doesn't, you know, you don't think about the waving fields of golden grain that are now growing genetically modified frankenwheat.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't know that sort of was preaching. I apologize.
Well, no, but I mean, I guess I was, you know, it's just easy to focus on water because it's water. I don't know,
yeah. You
know. And it just seems to be, you know, things seem to be going on that spells the end of communities and places where people now live. That's all.
Well, and remember,
a
lot of progressives got all quivery about T. Boone Pickens because he was into wind power, and they neglected to notice along the way that he was trying to buy up everybody's water rights too.
Mm,
you know,
these
guys are playing three or four moves out on the chessboard, and they know. They know that water is the next precious resource, and they will control who lives and dies by access to clean water.
Right, and that's the thing that these state political, you know,
Oh.
Yeah, it's just, there's no, they seem to be completely overrun by the fossil fuel industry. They have total control over these state houses.
I have sat in a permit hearing in Charleston, West Virginia, at West Virginia's utterly laughable, pathetic, Orwellian West Virginia Department of Environmental so-called protection, and I have heard a lawyer in open court, you know, when lawyers can't lie to the judge and everything, I heard a lawyer one time say, "Your Honor, if we required mountaintop removal surface mine operations to adhere to the standards of the Clean Water Act, there would be no mountaintop removal in West Virginia." And he used that not as an admission that there shouldn't be mountaintop removal, but that the law should not be enforced.
Right, right.
Jesus.
No, that's just, you know, I mean, yeah, it's incredible.
And don't think that's just West Virginia. You know, that's Alabama. That's Ohio. You know, Ohio's turning into a damn nightmare fracking world. And then, you know, just to extend the weirdness out, I think about my friends in Wisconsin, where they're not fracking, okay? Not fracking. No, they're doing low-rent mountaintop removal to blast into seams of sand that is deemed to be just awesome frack sand. So they're
right.
So they're putting all of those particulate toxins into the air for people in Wisconsin to breathe so they can get cancer like the hillbillies do. For sand to use in fracking. You know,
well,
maybe in the Dakotas or something. Who knows?
Right. Well, the other story that I thought was, I don't know what your thoughts on this, but the whole Joe Biden Sierra Club encounter. You know about that, right?
I read a little bit about it, but I don't have all the details.
Well, basically, I forget the woman's name, but somebody from the Sierra Club, you know, asked him at some sort of political event about the Keystone Pipeline. And his comment was, well, yeah, I'm against that, but I'm in the minority in the administration.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, you know, Joe Biden speaking out of turn again, or as it's been stated, he's just trying to separate himself for 2016. But, you know, I was sort of a bit, that was, you know, is that shit a done deal or what?
I've been thinking it is. I mean, I'm cynical for thinking it, but I'm thinking that it is. Because I keep going. I guess people get bored with it, but I keep going back. You know, if you don't put the phrase "modern pipelines" in your State of the effing Union speech, if you're opposed to Keystone XL.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you go. But I mean, I can end it on something a little bit positive. I was laughing at that story in Detroit where. I guess the fast food workers walked out and McDonald's called in some people to replace them, and then people, instead of replacing, joined the strikers.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I saw that and just laughed.
I don't know. I thought that was good. Now, I also think that this fast food stuff is really interesting as far as a labor movement go. So I just think it's, you know, if labor will focus on that, I just think it's a real positive development, you know?
Well, it is, and hopefully they will focus on it.
Because it's, you know, I mean...
Well, these are people doing for themselves.
Yeah, it's definitely an area that has enough workers to, you know, cause some tremors if they're able to be sort of organized. So, you know, you have to keep your eye on it because... We're not hearing about it on World News Tonight, but
No, they're too busy with Benghazi now.
Well, and that, I don't understand that at all because, what was it, 52 people died in embassy attacks during the Bush administration. Do you remember anybody having any hearings about that at all?
No. I think it was because they couldn't pronounce the names of wherever it was that blew up.
Yeah, well, the Benghazi thing is like, is that sort of like, Whitewater again, ain't it?
Oh, it's straight off the script.
Mm.
And it's sickening.
Mm, okay, well, listen, yep. You have a good weekend.
All right, you too, Sandra. Awful good hearing from you.
All right, bye.
Bye now. Sandra calling from California on the Skype line. Skype line is open, as are several of the phone lines. 304-658-3333. If you need to get on Skype, it's Bob Kincaid Horn. Yeah, here's the quick list of what Sandra mentioned. During the presidency of Dim Leader, January 22nd, Bartkoff has this up at as a graphic at his most recent page. January 22nd, 2002, U.S. Consulate of Kolkata, you know, Calcutta, five killed. June 14th, 2002, U.S. Consulate at Karachi, 12 killed. February 28th, 2003, U.S. Embassy of Islamabad, 2 killed. June 30th, 2004, U.S. Embassy at Tashkent, 2 killed. December 6th, 2004, U.S. Compound at Saudi Arabia, 9 killed. March 2nd, 2006, U.S. Consulate at Karachi, again, 2 killed. September 12th, 2006, U.S. Embassy in Syria, 4 killed. March 18th, 2008, U.S. Embassy at Yemen, 2 killed. July 9th, 2008, U.S. Consulate at Istanbul, 6 killed. September 17th, 2008, U.S. Embassy at Yemen, 16 killed. Total deaths, 60. Outraged Republicans, 0. So hopefully at some point in time, somebody will look at Daryl Issa or, you know, any one of those porcine freaks and call them on it. I remember the hearings you had, when 16 were killed at the U.S. Embassy in Yemen, except you didn't. I remember you talking about how, Condoleezza Rice was speaking too forcefully over the four killed at the U.S. Embassy in Syria. Oh, no, I don't, because you didn't. See how that works? Yeah. Yes, indeed. 3 minutes past the hour. We are into our final hour of the program this evening. So far, we still are looking for $90 to go with the other 60. So that we can meet up with the Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Many thanks to those of you who do step in to help. It is profoundly appreciated. Onward we go, back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Well, hey, Tracy, what's up?
Nothing. I was just listening to you and Sandra and what you were talking about, the hypocrisy of the GOP, and like you were saying about how with the Benghazi thing, and I'm waiting to, and I was like, when is somebody going to call them on this stuff? See, aren't you proud of me? I didn't say the other word.
Mm-hmm. Getting better.
I'm getting better. But when are they going to get called on this mess?
Well, or who?
Because I'm sitting there listening to, you know, If I hear, what's his name, Grandpappy Grumpy.
Grumpy Bomber John.
Right. It's like, dude, give it a rest. Give it a rest. For goodness sake. I mean, where are the hearings about what has happened in 9/11 and the mishandling of that?
Yeah, sorry. See, IOKIYAR. And in fact, I think it was Charlie Pierce that pointed out that Dick Cheney's out there with what he calls the Great Mulligan again. This thing is almost too bizarre to believe. Let me see if I can find the quote real quick. Because Dick Cheney, really, you know, Richard B., big-time Dick Cheney before he dicks you. Was actually
a man who shot somebody in the face. And his response was, "Well, he should have been in my way."
Right, and you know, he's every time I see that he's opened his mouth and spoken, I think about that poor human being whose heart is now beating in his chest, and I want to weep.
And you know, the person that died that in order for him to have a heart, you know, they were progressive.
Well, I'm wondering if he bought one in China.
He did, or else another country.
Oh, here it is. Here's the quote. Here's the quote. Dick Cheney gave an interview during a party in Georgetown celebrating the launch of a new book by Donald Rumsfeld. Okay? That's the setup. Here's the punchline. I got to get my throat ready for my Dick Cheney voice. He was speaking in regard to, of course, Benghazi, and he said, "They should have been ready before anything ever happened. I mean, it's North Africa, Libya, where they already had major problems. You know that Al-Qaeda is operating there, and you have some of the other Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups there, like Ansar al-Sharia and others." And then, and this is the real kicker, when we were there on our watch, we were always ready on 9/11, on the anniversary, he recalled. They were ready on 9/11. Ready.
Okay, see, I'm sitting in my cab right now trying to enjoy my cool, refreshing beverage.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't you... They were ready on 9/11?
We were ready on 9/11.
For what? Total destruction of the Twin Towers?
We were ready on 9/11. We'd ignored all those daily briefings and everything. We'd ignored it. We were ready.
You ignored everything that Clinton, because, you know, that Clinton said, you know, we've been listening and monitoring this. You might want to pay attention. No, that's okay. We're good. We got this. It just tickles my tootsie.
But the thing is, what was it, 2 weeks ago when some neo-Maxi Zoom dweeby stood up in the House of Representatives and said, George W. Bush at least kept us safe. How many terrorist attacks were there during George Bush's presidency? And then holds up his thumb and index finger together and goes, zero.
Wait a minute. Step back on that one, homie. Hold up.
Well, at least it wasn't honky. Okay, so.
This is one of these things, because remember, I don't listen and watch and pay attention to the news as much as you guys do.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank you. And
your mental health is significantly better for it, trust me.
Well, let me tell you, and the only reason is because I finally got the cocktail right for the call from, you know, with the pain and the depression and everything. I have to take in the morning Cymbalta and Lyrica and 800 milligram of Motrin. In the afternoon, I have to take another 800 milligrams of Motrin, and before I go to bed, I have to take a Lyrica, 800 milligrams of Motrin, and sometimes a Soma. And so that's the only reason why I'm balanced.
Don't get any of those out of order, or everything's going to go to hell.
Yes, in a handbasket. So wait, you're telling me that this fool stood up and said...
The fool is a member of Congress.
I know, and that's what I'm saying. This elected official that somebody sent to Washington, voted this fool into Washington, you know, into office, and this is what I'm trying desperately not to cuss, stood up and said, at least George W. Bush kept us safe. Does anybody own a computer? Does anybody have the internet? Because I'm pretty well sure that in 2001,
yeah, there was this little thing that happened.
There was an internet, and I mean, there was no Twitter, there was none of that, there was no Facebook, but there sure as hell was the internet, and there was television, because I remember sitting at home, I was getting ready for work, I had a customer I was supposed to pick up, and she called me, because her family's from New Jersey, that was Jersey Shore, so her family is watching on the other side in New Jersey, watching all this happen, and she's telling me to turn the news. So there were people filming this, yeah? And there was there is evidence.
Yeah, and George Bush flew all over the country in a hissy, flew to Louisiana, then he flew to...
Florida?
No, then he flew to Nebraska.
Yeah, Nebraska.
Yeah.
While also making sure that the Bin Laden family gets out of the country on private jet.
there was that as well.
Okay. So, let's, as I digress, I'm going to say, so this motherfucker stood up in Congress.
Yeah, he did. I know. All that hard work for nothing now, Tracy.
I can't.
Stood up in Congress and said, yeah. And held up them little sausage-like fingers together to make a zero.
Speaking of sausage, so I hear our boy Chris Christie went under the knife.
Yeah, emergency surgery. Or not emergency, elective surgery to make him 60 pounds lighter. Yeah, I think it was Sandra who pointed out on Twitter, I told you he was running.
He's running. He is running. Because there is no... Look, the last fat president we had was... Who was
Taft. Taft. Yeah, they had to have a derrick to get him in and out of the bathtub. That's not a joke.
He's running. I know.
Yeah.
He's
Christie's running. Rand Paul's running. Rubio's running. Ted Cruz thinks he might...
The only person that might have a chance to get the nomination, I would think, would be Christie. But I don't know. He pissed off a lot of people during Hurricane Sandy when he actually, thanked President Obama for his help.
Yeah, you can't be doing that.
You can't be dunking that Negro.
Mm-mm.
No, honey, child. You can't be thanking him because, see... that's that Negro. The atheist Muslim.
Oh no, the Kenyan Muslim socialist with the deep-seated hatred of white people.
Right.
That one in our White House.
That one. That there one.
You remember who gave us that one, don't you, Tracy?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was the Grumpy Bomber too.
Grumpy Pappy. I sit here, and it's a gorgeous day in L.A., and...
Aren't they all?
And I'm listening to Sandra, you talking about the environment, about the fracking and stuff, and it brings pause to my reflection on, what's next. And remember, I think I said this yesterday, when we were talking about, how, what do the rich people think is going to happen? That they're going to be able to build themselves a bubble, and all this horrible pollution and stuff that they're throwing into our world and into our country is going to go away. Well, it's not going to affect them because they're going to be in the bubble.
They'll be able to afford the water, Tracy, because we won't.
We won't. We won't.
Isn't it lovely, the brave new world that they have in store from us? For us.
For us. I was listening, I was talking to, because I got some really wonderful news that my son is going back. He's been taking classes here and there, but he's going to go back to school for real and finish up his degree because he wants to go into politics. Well, and I was talking to a friend of mine who is a retired.
Oh, talk him out of it. Tell him there's still honest work. He could be a piano player in a whorehouse.
Well, he wants to go into stuff about unions and stuff like that and environmental concerns.
I'm being a smart aleck, you understand.
I know. But I was talking to a friend of mine, she's a family friend, who is a major, she just retired from the SEIU. And now she's a consultant. And I was telling her what Alex wants to do. And she would be more than happy to take her, because she's about to go to Washington for the, I'm going to mess this man's name up, the Porter, the union, the guy that formed the union for the Porter, the Coleman Porters. Come on, Randolph. Anyway, she's going to Washington because I guess it's the 50th anniversary or something, and that plus the King thing and everything, but she's huge. She does consulting work for unions and getting unions started and stuff like that. So she's like, well, she's going to, she said when Alex is, because there's...
Yeah, A. Philip Randolph, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
No, yeah, thanks, Barky, and, yeah.
Well, I figured, come on, guys, help us, help me out. But it's like, we had this conversation, because I told her how I get into these heated discussions about unions and why they are still needed. And I said, you know, it's because of union that we have stuff like OSHA and stuff. It's because of unions that stuff that happened, what happened, that horrific accident in Bangladesh, wouldn't happen here. Well, it might still because of, you know, but the Triangle Fire, you know, up in New York in the 1800s, all that came about, all those unions came about because of that, worker safety, workers' rights, and whatnot, and so forth.
True. All the truth.
You know, and I'm just like, why is it? Why can't? So I was talking, you know, me and Alex were talking, Alex is my son, we're talking about unions, and we're talking about taxis, and how it would be wonderful if we could unionize, because I see some, Bob, I see these drivers, you know, work, I'm blessed because I have, you know, I'm in a relationship, I have my girl, and I am now part of a two-income family, so I no longer work the way I used to work, you know, 7 days a week. 15 hours a day. And so, but I'm looking at these other drivers who, you know, once they stop driving, once, you know, they have nothing. They have no pension. They have no health care. They have no nothing. And, you know, and the guys that own these cabs, the owners are just getting richer and richer. I mean, basically, being a taxi cab driver is a one step above being a sharecropper.
Just about.
Really,
yeah. Well, or the urban equivalent thereof.
Right. Or, you know, of the coal miners. You know, owe my soul to the company store.
Yep.
Or something like that. Yeah, I'm not. You know. So you know, when the rich start, you know, hearing about unionizing, and they get scared, and then they start doing the fear factor thing, where, you know, unions are corrupt and they do nothing for you but still take your money and blah 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 blah,
and on and on
and on and on. Where then what are you doing? I mean, do I have any benefits because I'm working with you guys? Do I have any rights that if you don't like me anymore you can just take away? It's so funny, you know, when I think about, you know, workers' rights. Now, a job, your boss can fire you at any given time they want to, right? But you have to give 2 weeks' notice before you quit your job. I mean, you
right.
don't have to, but, you know.
Unless you just happen to have been caught turning in a dissertation in 2009 that says that... brown people are not as smart as white people, in which case you can clear your desk out and be out by the day's end, and never mind working out the notice.
Right. So, I mean, it just boggles the mind. And it's the same thing with taxis. If an owner decides that can get at any time, decide, you know, I don't want this gear in my cab anymore, or even worse, they sell the cab. See, what happens is the owner has a right at any time to sell his cab. He doesn't have to give the driver notice or anything.
Right.
He gets to sell his cab. So there you go. Seriously, you could be driving and working, and you'll get a call on the radio saying, come to the office and turn in your keys. Your owner's still in the cab.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you have bills to pay or anything like that. Fortunately for me, I have a really awesome owner. And he's just a really, really, really good guy. So that's one thing I don't have to worry about. As a matter of fact, if he ever decided to sell my calf, he would give me first chance at buying it. You know, he would talk to me first and say, are you interested in buying the calf? And then he could work out payments and whatnot and so forth. But he's the rarity. He is not at all the norm. So it's just, you know, one of those things like how yesterday after I hung up, I was listening to a bit of the show about, you know, privilege and what it has done to this country.
Right.
And how people are just oblivious to other people and their plight. And they don't care. That's the thing. There's people that are oblivious, and there's just some people that just don't give a crap. You know, it's not me. It doesn't affect me. So why should I care? You know, as long as, you know, like Sandra was saying about that the act where it won't affect the nannies and the gardeners and stuff like that. It'll affect everybody else. Well, because I have to make sure that when I go get my teddy and my nanny and go to the gym, you know, Rosita is at the house taking care of the kids and cooking my husband's dinner. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger's case, servicing him at the same time.
No, yeah.
What? What?
Nothing. Just, I like the way you work that in there. Tracy, have yourself a wonderful weekend.
You do, my too. And I just sent $25. I know it's not much.
Bless your heart. You just pushed us. Then you finished off meeting Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. So thank you very much.
Yay! Well, you have a fabulous rest of the weekend. We're going to... Oh, before you go, my mom just sent me a text. Hold on. About some restaurant, something, Citrus Cove in Virginia Beach.
You're not going to Virginia Beach?
Well, she asked if we can go to Virginia Beach. I don't know. That's her.
Man, you're taking the long way to D.C.
It was just...
It's mama. It's mama. I got it.
My mom. What can I do?
I know.
So you have a blessed rest of the week and have a great weekend, and I hope to talk to you soon.
All right. You take care and drive careful, Tracy.
Always.
Bye now. The lady cab driver, Tracy, calling from somewhere on the side of the road in L.A. And we did. We thank you very much. Thanks to Jack, and thanks to Randy, and thanks to Tracy. Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge has been met. Much appreciated. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Well, hey, Preston.
I wanted to say greetings from Denver.
Indeed, and thank you.
Yeah. Been enjoying appreciating the conversation here on the front porch.
It's a pleasant... I was surprised. It's been so gray and rainy here. I walked out the door early today, and it was warm, and went, well, this is weird.
You know, it's been gray and rainy here, and we've gotten a few snow showers, too, and it's been such a godsend. It's been nice.
Oh, if I saw a snowflake, I would swear at individual snowflakes if I saw them now. All the way to the ground. You black...
Yeah. It's definitely rain here now. It's been about 60, but very cloudy.
Yeah, and you can use the rain, can't you?
For sure.
It can fall and drain down into one of those aquifers that the frackers are poisoning.
Yeah.
I'm such a little ray of sunshine sometimes.
Well, you know, it's good to be honestly, you know, share our despair over this stuff, our outrage. I was just reading something by Robert Jensen, actually, on that topic of, you know, seeing the apocalyptic part of life going on and recognizing that, confronting those feelings and that reality. Like, you know, mountains being blown up and trout streams being destroyed and all that mess. But on the good side, well,
it's got to be there somewhere, Preston. You're the resident optimist.
Well, how about this? They just found a new species of bee in Texas, a sort of leafcutter bee. and the scientist in Canada, if you discover a species, you can name it. And this guy chose to name the bee after Noam Chomsky.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. So Chomsky actually came.
So it's together. Like, what would that be? It's Apes Chomskyensis?
Something like that. Very close. I just found out about it on his Wikipedia page. And if people aren't familiar with Noam Chomsky's work, they might want to at least check out that much. When you see right-wingers like David Horowitz dedicate a big part of their lives to trying to smear the guy, you know Chomsky's up to some good work. And there's a whole industry trying to smear Chomsky and Alex Jones, and the ironically named Truth Movement is a part of that, right? So, you know, he gets labeled as the gatekeeper and all this other stuff. But anyway.
Well, I noticed a story about him today where he did some, and I think he engaged in a lot of soul searching. That's probably the wrong word. Before he did so, but he joined an effort to convince Stephen Hawking not to go to Israel and give legitimacy to some conference taking place at Ben Gurion University.
Hmm.
And he said he did so with real trepidation, but he felt like his concern over the way that the Palestinians are being treated outweighed any academic concerns he may have had. Is Hawking going, not going, don't know. A number of academics have signed a letter imploring him not to go.
And you said Chomsky was part of that?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I guess I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, maybe people can go, and while they're there visiting, they can connect with people and advocate for the Palestinians.
The counter argument that was made by somebody associated with this forum or whatever it is at Ben Gurion University. He said, "What we have here is actually one of the few places where Palestinians and Israelis freely interact and intermingle."
Mm, yeah.
And you don't want to interfere with that. But by the same token, so many times we talk about the fact that consumer choices are moral choices, ethical choices.
Yeah.
I mean, I've put products back on the shelf in the grocery store because they came from Israel.
Yeah.
Not because I hate Israelis I felt the same, it was the same way with South Africa.
Yeah. I've bought some olive oil from the occupied territories, kind of a fundraiser for a solidarity group, and things like that. But boy, that's interesting that you mentioned how that conference at Ben Gurion University, that's a place where Palestinians and Israelis intermingle. You know, it'd be good for Americans to see that as well, because we so often see them framed as just being pit against each other intractably, and that's not the reality at all. There's a book called Peace Be Upon You, A Thousand Years of Muslim, Jewish, and Christian Cooperation in the Middle East. And
it hasn't always been this way.
Right. And I guess that's part of the good news, that we can keep that in mind. And Yes Magazine, I think, is another part of that good news. I just got their most recent issue, and the title, the cover story, is called Love and the Apocalypse, Why Radical is the New Normal. And again, they, they talk about the good stuff going on. So.
And it is most definitely out there. I mean, a couple of little good news. I mean, I focused largely on the ill effects of what the guy had done, but the fact that the justice system worked and that this god-awful judge in Pennsylvania is going to do near 30 years in prison for selling children into the bondage of the for-profit prison industry. You know, that's a good thing. It's nice to see that the system works once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I agree. I also wanted to mention on the, Sarah, do you know Sarah Van Gelder? She's actually the editor of Yes Magazine.
I recognize her name probably from Yes Magazine.
She was out here about a week or two ago. Denver hosted the National Media Reform Conference.
I was gonna ask you how that went.
You know, I so would have loved for you to have been there. I mean, next time for sure, we're going to have to set that up. It was fantastic, though. It was Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Was there. Again, Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine. She did a conference, a workshop on solutions media, and just a lot of interesting stuff like that. People from Occupy Wall Street were there, a lot of grassroots activists, and then some of the leading scholars on the issue, like Robert McChesney. I don't know if you know his work, but he's with Free Press.
Yes, I've read it in the past.
Yeah. John Nichols.
Oh, yeah. There. I consider him a friend.
Great. He's a good guy. And so many others. There's a labor panel, and it brought to mind Rick Smith, and I asked one of the panelists if they knew of Rick's work, and he did. He's a guy with a union of mass transit workers in Philadelphia, SEPTA. And so, yeah, word's getting around. It's fun to see. And what else? Oh, speaking of Rick Smith, I want to send him a shout-out. Apparently, today is his birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, Rick.
Yeah, he's a Facebook friend of mine. And, boy, what great work he's doing. And so, yeah, anyway, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but...
Oh, you're doing just fine, Preston. No worries. But so you attended the festival?
I did. They held it. Excuse me. Water, a beautiful thing. Let's not pollute it. You know, I've never come to appreciate water so much as when I've started to take yoga and just sweat. Like I've never sweat before, and water after those classes, it's just amazing.
Bracing.
Yeah.
Well, no, I was just going to ask. Was there a common theme to this event, Preston, or was there? Did you get a sense that there are solutions being put forward, or
there are efforts? There are. You know, sometimes they try to solve things. Sometimes they're just trying to lessen the problems, ameliorate them or something, or just recognize them at least, you know, beginning there. A range of approaches, you know, with grassroots media developing, low-power radio, low-power FM, internet efforts, and then also going on at the federal lobbying level. Michael Copps was there, actually, the FCC chairman, who is a more of a liberal person. And kind of like the opposite of the Colin Powell's kid on the right-wing side of the Federal Communications Commission was Michael Copps, and he gave a talk, and it was right on. And there were also a lot of artists there as well. They really integrated a lot of the arts, some powerful poetry, both local here in Denver and some national artists. I don't remember their names, but there was this lady who some of your audience might recognize named Kimia Dawson, and she did this song. She became kind of famous for a song that the movie Juno used.
Yes.
Kind of a sweet love song. And but she did a song on climate change at this conference that, you know, really moved me to tears.
How long did it last?
It was over the weekend. It started on a Friday evening, and it took place at the Sheraton downtown. Hopefully that's unionized. Saturday and Sunday. And the Friday, actually, that opened it, a friend of mine organized this welcoming party at this beautiful club we have here called the Mercury Cafe. And it was the premiere showing of this film called Shadows of Liberty. And I think that comes from a Thomas Paine quote. Shadows of Liberty. And it's kind of it's about the corporate media. It very much felt like, manufacturing consent 2.0. And very well done. Beautifully, just informative. The cinematography, the music, just really work. And, it was a cool, the director of the film was actually at the club as well. Amy Goodman was there, and, Norman Solomon was there, and the Truth Movement was there confronting everybody, and they were doing a mix of things, but Webster Tarpley was there, and he immediately started dissing the conference, participants in the conference. It was irritating. He is...
irritating.
You know, and he has some progressive left stuff to him that I agree with.
But I'm a cynic now, Preston, and I, you know, scratch a cynic, you'll find a broken-hearted optimist. But
right.
That's kind of like the shtick that Alex Jones was running. Okay,
yeah.
I remember the Bush administration when there were a lot of people who were getting themselves all. Oh, look, he's criticizing George W. Bush. He must be a progressive like me.
Yeah.
Probably the wrong accent for that, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
And of course, like I've said before, the very, very organized effort by the libertarians and the Paulistas to infiltrate Occupy, you know,
what
you do is you have these little smatterings of... there are these little beliefs where you can say we've got common ground on that, and then you sucker them into the rest of the bullshit.
The con. That's how they operate. You'll gain your trust in some ways, and then pull you into something, a larger cause that you really don't want to be a part of, unless you like right wing libertarian John Birch, Lyndon LaRouche kind of. I don't know. I don't think it's, and it's pro. It's totally pro-gun. It's anti-feminist. Alex Jones loves Phyllis Schlafly. He's on the board of the John Birch Society. Most recently, I noticed he gave great respect to that James O'Keefe guy.
Oh God!
Who took down Acorn with his media
scam?
Yeah. So they're like provocateurs in a way. Instead of being of a certain form before, they're doing a lot of stuff that's pretty, it's really manipulative. And, we're not hopeless or helpless to it, you know, at all. And a lot of their stuff's getting called out in powerful ways. This weekend, people might want to check out Book TV if they've got C-SPAN 2. It covers the whole gamut of political opinion. They do a lot of right-wing stuff for sure. Heritage Foundation has just set up camp on Book TV, C-SPAN 2.
Well, okay. They're very effective at what they do. It's just that what they do is so damned evil.
Like you said, though, they've got some really good organization going on. But, you know, at least we're organized enough that there's actually a bookstore in D.C., right in the belly of the beast, called Busboys and Poets.
Oh, I love that place.
Yeah. And they've broadcast several book readings from that store. on Book TV, and it's been great to see. And anyway, people like Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, she may have been there. There was a tribute to Howard Zinn, actually, that the Busboys and Poets hosted. And but anyway, this weekend, there's a guy named Gar Alperovitz, and he's written a book. Well, he's written a few. One was something like Beyond Capitalism or America After Capitalism or something like that. And he's doing a lot of work on cooperatives and, you know, different sort of, you know, workers actually owning the businesses kind of setups. And anyway, he's going to be on Book TV this weekend and somebody else. But along with a slew of right-wingers, which, you know, but I must say it's...
The usual suspects.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what else? I don't know. Again, I'm just really enjoying this spring. It's been a beautiful spring, despite all the calamities and tragedies. I'm so glad Tracy mentioned that horrendous you know, those people dying.
Yeah.
But there's always this sort of regeneration going on, and so that's...
Well, one hopes. One hopes. I'll tell you what, Preston, I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and I hope we will talk again soon sometime.
I'd like that very much.
All right. Take care.
Good night, man.
Hope you have some sunshine this weekend.
Thanks.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Our buddy Preston, the Horns resident optimist, calling from Colorado. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob Kincaid, Mark Hankins.
Hey, Mark, what's happening?
Not much. I just wanted to thank you for putting connecting a lot of the dots. The new director of the NRA, a lawyer, a person that mentions the war of northern aggression, a native Georgian, and then coincidentally, within a week, somebody on a radio station talks about a 10,000 man march with rifles, and you are actually interpreting a lot of those movements, not to consolidate the reality of it all, but your warning. So your instincts are very good, and that would indicate to me you would have made a hell of a good Marine, Bob. But
well, thank you, Mark.
You're son of a sailor, and you're a fighter, and you have an eye for justice. So that keeps you on the right track. So I thank you, because a lot of this scary reality, I don't want to become an actual reality. And I was contacted by a friend of a friend through Facebook that has liberal leanings, like ourselves, on the show, and some right winger on there. And I said, well, if the Washington D.C. police fail, then they can resort to the county, and then if that fails, then they can consult with the state, and if they're not successful...
Well, don't forget, there's also the Capitol Police.
Capitol Police, which is its own... that's right, they're their own... they're not federalized by any... Are they, Bob?
Well, I mean, yeah, they're federal. They're federal authorities because they are...
Yep.
They're answerable to the Congress.
Well, that's right, that's right, because there was an issue... there was an issue concerning that, a couple of cases here in the last few years concerning shootings and some warrants and stuff. So I think you are right. So and then I had to leave my snide remark because I, you know, I'm not educated in the Constitution, but I apparently the U.S. Navy coincidentally is able to be dispatched domestically. I don't know if that's accurate or not. And of course, at this one point, I would admit that the Marine Corps is a division of the Navy, so they. They always have the Marines at 8th and I, and so if that is if they fail at their mission, then we may want to be concerned because they show up with air.
Well, I haven't seen the latest numbers, but I assume that he's probably getting more sign-ons. He wants 10,000 people,
mm-hmm.
And what he's trying to do is come up with enough numbers to theoretically overwhelm the law enforcement forces of the D.C. area.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds like strategy and tactics of someone who intends to do violence.
It actually, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there is, in my mind, a direct environmental connection to this story, and that would be the Koch brothers who own Transamerica, who are putting pressure on this current president through ignorance and racism, and the addition of the fools that have NRA stickers on their vehicle, and squirrel it all together and have the Tea Party, the manufactured dissent party, to put pressure on our first black American president, which I have no doubt in my mind that he'll handle the situation quite gracefully, surrounded by geniuses to include himself. So I do thank you with that, and I know we're getting towards the end of the show. I just wanted to also, since the last caller who I always enjoy listening to, a very peaceful guy, that the Rick Smith show, they opened their show last night, Bob, talking about mountaintop removal. And then the woman hosted the show, so Rick had celebrated his birthday, Pat LaMarche, who I had not heard of, so I read about her. She also brought up she had a guest on the show, and talked about, I was also not familiar with, I was aware of total information awareness, but I wasn't aware of the program prior to that called the Huston program. And, surveillance, counter surveillance on college and whatever, domestic spying, and who would fall within that. And then she had the sister of one of the victims shot, of the 15 students shot at Kent State. So I find it all kind of interesting that it all ties together, and I think that being still alive on Earth, knowing what happened to Robert Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy in our tragic history, that this time we could be fooled, but I'm just saying that nobody is stupid. So I appreciate it, and I'm actually arguing with a friend of mine. I won't say his name, but I downloaded on Facebook. He's a retired FBI agent. He's been featured on CNN recently, and he's become a I'll just say it over there because I won't mention his name. I call him a kooky religious right winger, and I say, "You don't make sense, bro. You're out of control with reality." And I said, "I'm sorry you had to go to Iraq so many times, but you placed yourself there for the per diem." And I said, "Do you not realize that all your efforts of bravery may have been because you're a minority hire in the FBI, and you had to do that to get promoted to sustain your living?" And also, and I sent him the information on Facebook, not just himself, but anybody was willing to look at it. This report that you talked about from the stupid ass Heritage Foundation, and then who's the public relations spokesman? A guy named Gonzalez. So, I said, "Bro, this is the heart and soul of these are the folks that generate the talking points, which go to Rush Limbaugh and all the right wing talk shows across the nation."
That is absolutely 100% unvarnished truth, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, look, it's not an accident that they hired a guy who has a taste for racist IQ theory.
Mm-hmm.
Not an accident at all. But once they got caught, they had to pretend that it was.
Well, I've lost track of the last few hours because I brought my nappy ass over here to the coast of East Florida to watch the first black golfer kick the shit out of a bunch of crackers. And a lady in the parking lot at my hotel tonight, you may appreciate, Bob, a damn Yankee. She said that she was pulling for Snedeker, and she said that she wished she could boo Tiger. And I said, "All that because of what? And because of his relationships with women?" I said, "Let me ask you if we have this in common, even though you're an extreme right winger." And I said, "Do you think any of the girls that Tiger dated after his father died and his gold Norwegian wife walked out on him, didn't know who the hell he was, and didn't know that he was worth $1 billion? I said, "Fucking Al Capone had girlfriends, bro. You ever looked at his face?" So
I've kind of reconsidered my opinion of Tiger Woods once I realized that his now ex-wife Elin Nordgren has been swanning around with a mountaintop removal pig.
Well, there we go again, Bob. So it's funny how faster the world is moving closer to itself, and all things are connected. And you and I are in the eye of the storm. And again, I say this. I've said it to you many times. Your father and your family and the people that you were around, it to me as a damn Yankee, I'm not saying that there aren't a lot of ignorant Yankees. There are. Maybe more than in the South. The Southern people seem to be educatable because they, they're just, they seem to be a humble people, that are approachable. But Bob, your foundation just constantly blows me away, and like the gentleman from Ohio says, and your education is much appreciated, because I don't know a lot of the things you talk about, but I can follow them when I figure them out, and your heart and mind are a gift to anybody who listens to this damn show, and I thank you, Bob.
Well, thank you, Mark. Let me make a suggestion before you go, just because you do have that interest in understanding cross-cultural or crossing cultural boundaries. Anybody who wants to learn just the mindset and the thinking owes it to themselves to own the two books that Joe Bagent wrote toward the end of his life, Deer Hunting with Jesus and Rainbow Pie. You just got to own those. They will absolutely knock you down.
Deer Hunting with Jesus, I was familiar with. I did not realize he wrote them both, and I did not realize he was gone. I did see a snippet of an interview with him, Bob, on C-SPAN. I do need to own that. And there was an author feature today, Florida in B-flat, talks about not quite the same context, but to some degree. I will get my hands on both of those. Of course, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman by Perkins, and then
right.
Also Pipe Dreams, with the connection between Enron and the privatization of water. And there are stainless steel buildings in the state of Florida, if you look closely at them, even though they are fenced, they'll have the little tiny word on there that says Hazrix. And this was their agenda here. It still is with Aquifer. And they are putting meters in Marion County on all these crackers' free water wells. And what's behind that? It's the water companies, which is actually behind the hand of Coca-Cola, and obviously there's no surprise there. So it's all for sale, and I thank you, Bob, for keeping your heart involved. I do know that you do pay a cost, and there's nothing we can do to help you with that, but we do all thank you for being in the eye of the storm. And my back is with yours, brother, so don't worry about that.
Well, thank you, Mark. You have a good evening and a great weekend.
Good night. Semper Fi and Tiger will win this tournament tomorrow. Good night.
All right. Bye now. Mark calling from Florida. And, yeah, it's time to get out of here. Many thanks go out to everybody who makes all of this happen and has made it happen for lo these many years. Thanks to everyone who met Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge tonight. Thank you very much. And thanks to everybody who through the years has contributed to keep this going. It's the only reason it's still here. It's the only reason I'm not standing somewhere saying, "Welcome to Walmart." Really. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT.org, ACHECT.org. Go there and learn how you can be a part of ending the Appalachian apocalypse. It is, believe you me, sincerely appreciated. Mother's Day is this weekend. To all the mothers, a very happy Mother's Day. And for those of us who no longer have ours, the warmth, the love, and the comfort of fond and loving memories. Happy Mother's Day. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
And Rick Smith is next on the Horn.